Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timory.
I know you're not getting married anytime soon, Don. However, I think that this story is very newsworthy. And I think it's one of those very sweet elements that has a lot to say. There was an article not too long ago on Orange County Catholic, in fact, talking about Sister Maria Laura, who is at the Augustinian Monastery of St. Rita in Italy. And very neat story. So this monastery is actually where St. Rita ended up going to and entering the convent and becoming a religious sister later on in life.
I was not familiar with St. Rita until I saw this story. And St. Rita is the patron saint of difficult marriages.
Yes.
She was married to someone, sent off by her parents to marry someone when she was very young.
12 years old, in fact.
Yeah, the man was abusive. And eventually, after many years, he died. She moved to this convent, and that's the place where they go.
And she entered the monastery at 36 years old. So she lived a very, very challenging life for a number of years. But now, being this patron saint of marriages, many people traveled to this church or this monastery in Italy asking for the intercession of St. Rita in their marriages. And often what they do, and it's just become a tradition or a custom, is that women will actually donate their wedding dresses to the convent, offering them up as a token for St. Rita's intercession. And what's happened is this convent has actually collected hundreds upon hundreds, if not thousands, of wedding dresses.
And now they are putting them to good use thanks to Sister Maria Laura, who has a background as a seamstress.
She was previously a seamstress and a designer. She joined monastic life at the age of 28. But being a designer in Tuscany, I think that this shows such a neat element, especially for anyone who's maybe discerning religious life, whether they're thinking about becoming a monk, a religious sister, or a priest, whatever it might be. One of those moments where you realize the gifts and talents I have, even if they're not being used immediately in my immediate future, there are different ways I can bring them in. And this is what Sister Maria has done. She now has taken these dresses and is offering them to women who maybe can't afford to have dresses. They have dress fittings and they're bringing women in, fitting them, letting them choose their dresses. And then she custom tailors the wedding dress to the woman. And they can leave with any type of donation they're able to give. Again, supporting then the monastery there.
Yeah, this is a fantastic story all the way around. I just love every aspect of it. One, the wedding dress is a big deal. I may not be getting married again soon. But
hopefully not getting married
been.
Again, right?
And the wedding dress. So I love this because my wife actually got married in a used wedding dress. We found her wedding dress at a thrift store. She paid $8 for her wedding dress. It was a beautiful white lace dress. She was gorgeous in it. We were in love and wanting to get married. I've shared a bit of this story before. And, you know, we wouldn't do it this way necessarily now as a Catholic, but in those days, back when I was younger, we just wanted to get married. The wedding dress was a big financial burden. It was a huge blessing to be able to find a used one that she could get married in. And so I know that the stress, the financial stress, especially today, what's the average cost of a wedding today?
Oh, my
In America, it's like
$30,000
something.
Yes.
I mean, just insanity, right? Like, how could we possibly afford $30,000 for a one day? I mean, but it is a big day, and there's a lot of pressure to be able to get a used wedding dress custom fitted by a professional seamstress. I don't know, pretty sweet deal all the way around.
And many choices, and I mean, not even just that, but the fact that you're getting it at the Monastery of St. Rita, and the element there, Mickey saying it's this Italian yarn is helping women say yes to the dress because she actually says she can tell which dress these young women are going to choose.
Yeah.
And it's neat for her. And again, using these skills, what an incredible moment. And also a ministry as well, an apostolate, where they're helping women who might not be able to get married. And there are stories of young women who said how well they were treated by the sisters there and being taken care of, and how truly they would not have been able to get married if it weren't for being able to obtain these wedding dresses.
Now, Rita's. I have a question for you, Timmy. What about the notion of going to the patron saint of troubled marriages before you even get married? What? Right. On one hand, I want to get your take on it, but on one hand, I kind of see the value in that.
Absolutely. When I saw that, I thought, this is so neat. In a time where young people are struggling to get married, stay married, or even think about marriage, what an incredible moment to recognize beforehand that this marriage needs Christ and his intercession in every step of the journey.
That's so true, right? Like, a lot of the times I think people get married, if they ever finally do, because it's going to bring them an even greater amount of happiness and joy. And this is just going to be so awesome. You know, we're both in love and we're going to stay on this emotional high for the rest of our lives. And then when that doesn't happen, when you get to the down times, then they're like, oh, well, it's past now. I guess I'm out, right? Like, okay, we'll get divorced or whatever, and I'll move on to something else. Where here we have, no, we're going to go to the place where the saint's going to help us through those troubled times that really, if you're honest about it, or if you're at least not completely naive, you should expect that there's going to be some troubled times, right? They're going to come, and the proper attitude is, we're going to get through these. Somehow we're going to get through, we're going to come through the other side stronger. That's what marriage is all about. It's not about staying constantly on an emotional high. It's about becoming one and growing with Christ at the center. And so I'm with you. I like the notion of going to the home of the patron saint of troubled marriages before you get married, just as a more realistic view of what this is all about.
Well, and I think, too, an element that is so beautiful in you saying that, Don, is that people don't understand that our vocation is our path to Christ. And when we talk about marriage, and I gave a talk on this recently, and the church is teaching on marriage, but the sacraments, marriage is a sacrament. The sacraments help us to get to heaven. And marriage being a sacrament, we miss the fact that we're called to redemptive suffering. And marriage is an element of redemptive suffering. It's an embracing of our cross. And this could be, I think, pertinent to you, and I hope you're paying attention, whether you're married, looking to be married, or whatever state in life you are, that our path to Christ isn't just roses and comfort, but it truly is an element of embracing our suffering that we have, trying to use that suffering to kind of tick away at our purgatory time and suffering here on earth, to perfect and use it now, the suffering now, to not just let it go to waste, but to strengthen and purify and cleanse us in our character and who we are before God.
Yeah, that's a revolutionary notion going into life, right?
Yes.
But marriage especially, I just think we have such an idealized, romanticized notion of what it's all about. And to have this idea that I'm going to help perfect you, you're going to help perfect me, that's sort of what marriage is about. And it's going to happen through suffering. You're like, yikes, when's the last time?
We want to run out the back door.
When's the last time you heard a commercial, you know, Brides Magazine or whatever? Well, all right, accept that suffering. You know, it's like, whoa, I don't know about that.
And I think that that's a moment that is to be taken seriously. I have a friend not too long ago. He's in his early 30s, and we were talking about marriage, and he was dating someone for the first time in a while, and they had been together a couple of years now. When I finally said, he's a very private person, I said, hey, are you guys talking about getting married? And he looks at me, and he's just, you know, sitting here, and I like to ask him very private questions because he doesn't like to talk about private things, and he usually just doesn't respond. So I thought, well, I'll have a conversation with myself, and at least he can have the answers in his head to know that he's thinking about these things, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm just asking really blunt questions that are obnoxious to frustrate him, and he does give me an answer to this one. Are you thinking about getting married? And he says, you know, Timmy, he says, marriage is a really serious thing. He said, it is a covenant before God. It is a covenant before God. And I think a lot of times people just think about a contract where I sign away my name and there are legal ramifications. A covenant is an exchange of persons before God. God is at the center. You're promising. You're making family. You're making a family unit here. And he said, that's serious. I have to really think about that. And it wasn't that he's some 30-something-year-old avoiding marriage. It's that he's someone who's living in his 30s, is seeing the culture that is so broken of marriage. And in a sense, he's going, I recognize this is a path to great suffering, but great joy at the same time. And I need to make sure I am choosing the right person.
Right. Because he knows going in, right? The attitude is, if I go in, this is for good. There's no just abandoning this at any point. Like, divorce is not something we are going to have as an option going in. If I'm going to commit, this is it. And this was my attitude. This is how I understood marriage, I think. And growing up, like, my parents weren't Catholic, but there certainly was in our family and in our circles the notion that, yeah, you get married, it's for life. And that's missing these days, where in the back of everyone's mind, you're like, well, it's not necessarily for life. I mean, it's for now. But no, understanding that it is for life and that the suffering that's going to come will make us better in the long run. But we're not going to give up, right? Like, we're going to suffer through this. We're going to make it. This is a lifetime commitment. Yeah, if we all entered into marriage that way, how much better off would we be, right? So I love this story.
Great. And I think that for anyone who's looking at getting married and maybe you're kind of trying to vet your potential spouse here, how do you guys handle suffering and challenge together? Because how you handle it now is a huge indicator of how you will handle it within marriage.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And I think that that's really important as we're walking and moving forward in our understanding of marriage and family life.
Timmery and Dawn will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Dawn Johnson Media. From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending with Dawn and Timmery, applying timeless principles to today's hottest topics.
Pretend you have your phone and you're swiping through a bunch of pictures, one after another after another. Now pretend you're in the dating sphere yet again, if you're not there already, and you're looking through pictures of people that you might potentially date. You're looking at one of those nice new dating apps that are so popular. I can't tell you, Dawn, how many friends I have who have gone through these dating applications and online dating. This one, you're trending, you're going through one after another after another. You might be interested, you do a swipe and you go backwards to glance at that picture. It sends a little notification to that individual, that woman. And now on this dating app, you're actually the one who initiates the conversation as a woman. You make the first move.
Yeah, this is called Bumble, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
And I was not familiar with this before this last week, Timmery. So the woman has to make the first move. You have to swipe left.
I think you have to make the first contact versus the guy's the one who can swipe left and you get a notification. So this girl has, I think, 1,946 young men who are interested in her,
right,
who have left swiped her.
Man. New York Times this past week is the story we're talking about. A young lady named Lauren Peterson wrote what I consider a heartbreaking, honest portrayal of the hookup culture. And we've talked about the sexual revolution a lot. I know it's on my mind as I'm doing a lot of research into the topic and what it has done to men, to women, to children. And I've said often on the show, women, I think, have been the hardest hit. Women and children have been the hardest hit by the sexual revolution. And one of the things the sexual revolution has done is made sex very cheap. This is something Professor Mark Regnerus over at the University of Texas has done a lot of work on. Friend of mine, he's got a new book coming out this summer about the cheapening of sex. Mm. And in the past, if you're an attractive young lady and you're in the, quote, marriage market, you actually had quite a bit of power. especially if all of the women around you had the same moral code that you did, right? Mm-hmm. You're not just going to go sleep with any man, and you are going to wait for the right guy to come along who has, and we were just talking about marriage in the previous segment, who has the proper qualifications. And so there was a lot of control, there was a lot of power, a lot of dignity associated with that setup, if you will, mm-hmm. for women, actually, right? That's mostly gone now.
The value for women, the value of women in the dating sphere is really degraded.
Yeah, because now, if you're a woman who withholds sex from guys, sorry, you're sort of out of luck, right? You're sort of on that periphery. Most men will not even consider
when they
going
have
out
access.
With you.
When they have the access, why not?
Men
why not
today have access to literally thousands of women who, unfortunately, are willing to have uncommitted sex with them. And here's the story. So this young lady leaves Michael's apartment one Tuesday morning. She smiled. She said, hey, have a good class today. And even just saying, have a good class today, was a big emotional marker for her. She was trying to communicate something with Michael. Now, here's what happened. She had been with him the night before. It had been a one-night stand, but it was their usual
one-night stand.
It was their weekly hookup.
She packs her contacts, puts on her backpack, walks the 5 blocks, shows up at his house. They talk a little, watch a little, eat something. They go to bed. Next morning, she zips up her jacket and walks home.
Every Monday night, this mm-hmm. happens. Tuesday morning, she leaves. She doesn't see him again until the following Monday evening. That's just how it works. Mm-hmm. She actually, though, finds that she likes to actually spend time with this man. Like, he's kind of a nice guy. And so she wants to communicate that she likes him, that she would actually like to spend more time than just the hookup on Monday nights.
She wants to go deeper. That's why her comment of saying, have a good class today, she's trying to open up a conversation. She's dropping hints that are completely lost on poor Michael.
Well, can you imagine? I mean, I know that I'm old and from a previous generation, but the notion of telling someone, have a good class today, yeah. the notion that that is communication, that mm-hmm. that is communication that, hey, I really like you. I want to go more than this. And then you've already had sex with this guy, right? Yeah. Like, how sad is that?
It's heartbreaking. But she's saying, well, she went and she broke all the rules because she started to become attached to him. She just said she noticed one day as she was turning the doorknob to her apartment after leaving his place, she realized she was still thinking of him. He was on her mind. So she decided to go ahead and send that text message after all of her subtle hints that were incredibly not understandable to want to go into a deeper conversation. She texts him and says, I like you and I want to be with you. Then she squeezed her eyes shut and pressed send.
And what do you suppose happened? He confessed his love for her and they all lived happily ever after? No.
He
Absolutely.
Likes her, too.
He does like her.
Via text message,
yeah.
by the way. Just saying. Come on, you guys. Let's communicate face to face.
But here's what she found out. She was not the only woman in his life. Not only did he have her on Monday nights, he had a different girl on Tuesdays, a different one on Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays. He had a different girl every night of the week.
So he ends up sharing essentially that while he likes her, he's fearful of commitment. And when the conversation's teased out, his real problem is he has a problem with essentially monogamy.
He has a problem with monogamy, yes.
But this is what's so fascinating is that somehow it took her a while to realize she had been thinking about Michael a lot longer than that. Because she outright says, well, I had noticed that he had texted this girl, I think her name was Sophie, and I noticed that he had become friends with her on social media and they had no friends in common. And I noticed a couple other girls he was friends with on social media that they had no friends in common. So I'm guessing these are probably just another couple of Bumble girls that are, again, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday night. But it shows that she's been ongoing developing this attachment. She's been stalking on social media, recognizing, well, these are probably the other girls. So while she's seeing this, she's realizing it's pulling at her the whole time. She cares so much that she's researching it.
Well, and this is the thing, isn't it? It turns out that you can't just go have unemotional sex with a guy one night a week and not feel any connection to him.
Yeah.
Guess what? That's not possible.
That's not possible. I mean, and I know I've talked about this a lot on the show, but when you're having sex with an individual, the hormones and different chemicals releasing, the serotonin, the norepinephrine, the oxytocin, all of the endorphins that are kicking in, the dopamine, these are chemicals that are saying relax and connect. They're saying get ready, something important's about to happen. Chemicals that are putting a little pair of sunglasses on you that help you to view your partner to overlook some of their flaws because of your sexual interaction with them. You are bonding on a physical, chemical, and emotional level. Sex isn't just sex. Sex is for making love for a lifetime. That's why I love when Dr. Jennifer Rowe Backmore says, let's not have sex anymore. Let's make love. Let's make something that's permanent.
Yeah, you're trying to separate sex, and indeed they have, from love, but it's not entirely possible in it due to the nature of the act. You are giving of yourself. Let's talk about the emotional aspect of it, the psychological aspect of it. When she packs her little pack with her contacts and her overnight case and goes over there and has sex with him, she is giving part of herself to him. There is a union formed there, not only physically, but emotionally, psychologically. It's impossible not to do that. But the problem is, and this is the problem with the contraceptive mindset in general, you're not giving everything, and he's not giving everything to you. You're not giving, for instance, tomorrow to that person, right?
Yeah. Like
you show up and you give tonight. Not all of me, the contracepted me.
Not even much conversation.
Not even much of knowing each other. You don't have to give time. This is what I'm saying. It's so cheap. Right, yeah. Sex has become so cheap.
Well, and she actually summarizes it without going. She actually doesn't talk about sex almost the entire time. She leaves that out. Notice that's intentional, because if she were to go into that part of the conversation, it would hurt too much. It would hurt too much for her. So she talks about how the whole thing's temporary. She said there's no point in going deeper when it's temporary. She knew that she was about to graduate. He was about to graduate. She was about to move away. He was an LA guy who clearly made it clear that he loved LA. So why would they go further? So there were parameters to this online dating element. It was just dating and their unspoken rules.
Exactly right. If you start out a relationship knowing that this is as far as it's going to go.
There's a deadline for it.
And yet you have sex. Guess what? That's another one of those things that just doesn't work, right? You're not, if I'm not giving you past next week or this semester or whatever it is, I'm withholding that. That means there's not love there, right? So true love, as John Paul II so clearly elucidated in his beautiful Theology of the Body, true love is the giving of oneself to another. But in order for it to be fully consummated, if you will, you have to give all of it.
Yeah.
That means all of your time, the rest of your life, and all of you, not a contracepted portion of you, but all of you.
It's total.
Total giving.
It's
That's
faithful.
What love is.
It's fruitful. It's permanent. These are elements to every sexual act and marriage and relationship that we should be developing. And this dating parameters, I mean, again, Don, this poor girl, Lauren, she knew that she was only keeping this relationship till she graduated. She even says, I didn't want the tears and the boo-hoos and all those elements that come along with it.
And do you think she missed those? Do you think she missed? Yeah,
and
right.
She recognizes that.
Exactly.
She had an age range and she had a distance within how far she was willing to go. And that was her five blocks for this young man.
I'm willing to give you five blocks of walking.
Right.
And, all of my body.
Yeah. And she's the one who walks over there. And she even says, you know, every morning she'd be zipping up her jacket. And he said, heading out. She said, yep, that was it. Like, that is the extent of their conversation. They wouldn't go much deeper about their family lives. They wouldn't introduce each other to their friends. These are areas you just don't enter into.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. This is Trending with Don and Timmery on Immaculate Heart Radio. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit donjohnsonministries.org or timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
So we're telling a story about Lauren, who shared her story and experience of dating through social media apps such as Bumble is what she had used. She talks about how she's essentially developed to truly care for him. It's more than just their one night, Monday night stand each week. It's more than wanting to go past her graduation and enjoying this temporary, I wouldn't even say companionship, but hookup, because they don't really talk. She even asked him if he wanted to do something for spring break, and that was, nope, I'm busy. There are other girls. When she says she wants a bigger commitment, he says, well, he has other relationships. This is where literally it shows how almost dehumanizing it is in a sense. She says, I stopped seeing his face as a yes or no to swipe on her cell phone screen on this app. She said, you know, essentially her mindset began to change. She wanted to get to know Michael. She wanted to get to know more about his family. And this was something that she was initially trying to avoid because she knew she was graduating and moving back home in just a couple months.
The notion that I saw him as more than that face on the screen. So let's just flesh that out literally.
Yes.
So in the beginning, for her and continually for him, they saw each other as objects to be used one night a week for physical pleasure. Mm-hmm. There was even rules in place like, no, there is no emotional attachment to this. That's the rule. This will end at a particular time. I'm only with you because you were within five blocks of me and I found you physically attractive. That was the only thing I needed to know about you. I don't want to know your likes, your dislikes. I don't want to know you. I want to use you. Then she starts to want to not use him. She wants to get to know him as an actual person, and she wants to be known as an actual person, but he's not willing to. He's like, no, you're an object. You're an object for my pleasure, and I've got six other ones this week, or who knows how many, maybe, you know, right? I've got all of these different objects, and frankly, and maybe this will sound sexist, but I do think it's easier for men to remain objectifying women than it is for women to remain objectifying men and themselves. Mm-hmm. It almost like she feels a little bit guilty about wanting him all to herself and wanting monogamy and wanting this relationship. And like, oh, I tried really hard not to want all this stuff. I mean, I signed up for the app and he's just an object and I'm just an object. But oh, deep down, I do want that.
She recognizes she was playing a game, Don, and she says it. I wanted to leave the game behind and develop something special. This is what's sad. She says, even if only for a short time.
Yeah, isn't so? What I wanted was love.
What she wanted was love, and she was searching for it in the wrong places, and not just the wrong places because she had the wrong attitude going into it. She was setting herself up to be objectified. She was setting herself up for a lack of commitment, a lack of friendship. She even says, we talked a little, we watched a little, and we went to bed. That was their relationship. And they played over again the next week. Nothing deeper took place.
It's interesting. She has a paragraph here. Dating apps are the courtship equivalent of next day shipping, where you don't have to twiddle your thumbs and wait for an adequate romantic prospect to drift by. They release a flood of potential suitors, your inbox notifications flashing red with heartbeats of their own. And the notion that it's like shipping. It's like instantaneous shipping. Well, what do you ship? Things.
Yeah.
Right? Like we wouldn't ship people. Mm-hmm. Right? We wouldn't shop for people. You get to know people. And I get maybe maybe we shouldn't use that term. If you're out there shopping for a husband, well, I guess that's better than shopping for a one night stand, which is clearly what these folks are doing. But she says, it's nice to imagine that Michael liked me the most. But even if that were true, I'm not sure what it counts for in a dating scene of instant gratification with seeming unlimited choices. That seems to be pretty accurate.
Well, and then she goes on right around that same area. She talks about how it struck her that the fling was dead. The idea of having, let's say, a summer fling, a gentle, in a sense, relationship. Sure, maybe, yes, it does involve sex, but just the idea of a short romance, let's say it didn't involve sex. That's no longer a thing. We have fling. She says plural because that's what dating apps encourage. They don't just encourage monogamy. They encourage multiple relationships, and not just multiple relationships, but actual active multiple sexual relationships.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're all about. It's like Amazon shopping for books, yeah. Only it's people that you can get physical pleasure from.
Now, I do have to say that I do know young women who recognize that this is the attitude many young men have going into these applications. But they have the attitude that they're trying to just meet someone. And they try to use the applications for the same reason. And they know that they have to go in with a strong moral compass and on the first interaction say, just so you know, I will not have sex with you. And not only on the first date, right. But I won't have sex till I'm married. And some of them immediately walk away. Some of them are willing to continue to develop the friendship. But I have to say, in my experience, from what I've seen, a lot of these girls are often settling. They're settling to just meet anyone at this point. And this is what's sad, is that we're so hungry for human connection, friendship, and love. Sometimes we need to work on finding that friendship and love in friendships with just friends. And allow ourselves to continue to develop our friendships, and we will meet someone if we're meant to.
Yeah, well, it's tougher and tougher, isn't it? I mean, I know women who would love to be married, and they, you know, are the first to admit, listen, I'm not getting any younger, Dawn. I just want to find someone.
Yes.
And it is hard. It's difficult. But you know what? Unfortunately, there's less and less good men out there. And I think that is a direct result of the sexual revolution. Mm-hmm. Again, and whoever you want to blame for that, we have created a generation or two now of men who are perfectly fine with using women as objects. And there's too many women out there now who are okay with being objects for men. And guess what? Those are not marriable men, unfortunately. Yeah. Those are just not people that you want to try to spend the rest of your life with.
You make me think of another challenge that I think we're seeing is that you said there are a lot of young women who would really like to be married. And maybe I have the conversations more so with young women than more young men, because I know I do have a number of friends who are young men looking to be married. I swear I should start matchmaking people.
There you go.
I'm kidding. But one thing that I see that's really challenging, and also being a young woman who's not married, that there's always so much pressure of, well, are you dating anyone? Are you talking about getting married? What's going on? Do you have marriage in view? It's really important to make sure that young people are open to marriage, that they're dating for the sake of marriage. But I do see a lot of pressure being put on young people to almost make them feel bad if they're not getting married and if they're not dating someone.
Now, this is interesting to me, Timmy, because culture-wide, I wouldn't see that. Do you think that's more specific to your Catholic circles?
I think this is an issue among Catholics who want to be married. Maybe Protestants, anyone who's wanting to be married, but they're having a hard time finding someone to marry.
Right.
Or they're having a hard time, maybe their student debt or whatever it might be that's keeping them from getting married. They can't afford to just yet. You know, they're living with their family or whatever it might be to make ends work. I think that we have to find that balance of encouraging people who aren't thinking about marriage to think about marriage and family and to expose them to it. And at the same time, people who are struggling and want to be married to not have to always ask them, yeah. Well, are you dating someone?
Right.
Have you set a date yet? Why aren't you getting married? Because these are, I think, sensitive topics that young women and men at times are having a hard time just meeting someone.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. And so, yes, I agree with you. I mean, if you are one of those people, I don't know a lot of those people. I guess we probably just run in different circles who are putting a lot of pressure on young people to get married. Mm-hmm. They do absolutely need to realize it's tough these days, not only to find the right person, but to get married at a young age. I mean, especially here in Southern California. I mean, it's very difficult to think you're just going to go get a job out of college and be able to live. And no, it's
within your means.
No, I mean, you know, you have to move away almost. Yeah, it's very, very difficult. So yes, I agree with you. I mean, I think in general, the culture is not expecting young people. It's expecting them to go out, sow their wild oats, and maybe we don't use those terms anymore. But
it's
go out,
true.
You know,
have fun
it's
now,
almost like we
settle down later.
We send them off to college knowing that they're going to be irresponsible and have a lot of cheap sex. And, oh, that's the college experience. And then we expect them to come out of that and be mature people. And the whole experience has been something that's making them less mature and less able to love and hurt. And so, it's the system is set up it's very difficult for a young person these days,
well, and it's
I think,
challenging.
In the culture.
I know people who have told, you know, young people who are in good, strong, committed relationships, well, why are you only dating one person? Why not, you know, test the waters out? Why don't you party and go out and meet other people? And it's just astonishing that so many people think that they can have such a strong, I think, influence. And when the reality is that we need to be encouraging people to be strong and wise and truthful and happy, not in a pleasure seeking way, but in who they are and developing their character. And yes, encouraging marriage and family and exposing them to that in a culture that many people aren't exposed to strong marriage and family, but still making sure that we're not, especially maybe in the smaller Catholic circles, over-pressuring people who really do want to be married.
Well, yeah, that's right. This New York Times writer, the young lady, she says at the end of her piece, she found that monogamy was going to require more sacrifice than ever. She's like looking at the cost. I want monogamy. I want that relationship. In this culture, that's going to be difficult. That's going to cost me a lot. That's going to require a lot of sacrifice. That's a good first step. I mean,
that's great.
We talked about that earlier. I think that's a proper approach to the subject. But also, we need to be working on making a culture that makes it a little easier for young people to find that monogamous relationship with other people who have been monogamous and who want that. I mean, oh, what a mess we create.
Timmery and Dawn will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Dawn Johnson Media. From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending. With Dawn and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
When is the last time it was completely silent around you? No radio on, not visiting with anybody else, TV was off, no sounds at all. Just think about that for a second. When was the last time that happened to you? I suspect that may have been a while. We don't live in a culture that really values silence or seeks after it. Timmery, I think we're a little bit outliers. I happen to like silence. I go to my office and I don't have the music playing and it's quiet in there. So I like the silence, and I can think it was, you know, not long ago that I was. What about you? You
like the silence? I love silence. Yeah. I really do. I'm actually a big fan of sitting in the car in total silence. For me, that's kind of just a time to have quiet, to gather my thoughts, maybe work through whatever is on my mind that I'm struggling with, or have a moment to be positive and look at what I've been going, or just sit there. There's something to be said of that simplicity.
Yeah, the not having to do anything necessarily, even, right? Like, I'm with you. I like silence so that I can think through things. But that's almost an action still, right?
There is true.
There is a sense in which, all right, I've got to think through this and I'm going to walk through these steps. And it's still a little bit like work. But there is a silence where you're actually just still and you're not trying to do anything. I'm not sure that I do that very well.
I don't know that I always do that very well either. But I notice that when I've not been incorporating enough quiet time, whether maybe the only time you can get silence is in the car with the radio off or whatever it might be, half an hour before bed, I notice when I don't have that are kind of moments that I actually struggle more, because it's not giving me the opportunity to work through things, like we said. But also, I'm not in tune with being open to spontaneous prayer. When something's constantly filling the noise in my background, when I'm thinking about it, you don't even have a moment to reconnect with our Lord at all.
Yeah, it's a reflection on us, like a moment of self-reflection, but also just being in the presence of God and being able to hear Him, adore Him, this sort of thing. Cardinal Sarah, who I'm a big fan of.
Cardinals. I love Cardinal Sarah. I heard him speak a couple years ago at the World Meeting of Families. I was sitting in the very front row.
Wow.
The benefit of traveling by yourself, you can sneak into the front rows of major conferences. I was sitting right behind a bunch of the cardinals from all over the world.
Wow.
And I had some bishops sitting next to me. It was really, really cool. But he is so endearing. Anyways, his new book, and I would really recommend anyone to pick up some of his books, but his latest one is The Power of Silence, which actually the end was written, one of those few moments where Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI has come out and had some type of written or formal thing to say very few times since he stepped down as Pope. And he, after reading Cardinal Sarah's book, actually asked if he could write an end section to the book because this silence is so powerful for him in his life.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. You write a book and Pope Benedict says, can I write a little afterword for it?
Right.
I think you've arrived at that point. I'm like, okay, this looks fantastic. I like the subtitle too, Against the Dictatorship of Noise. Mm. And to think of noise as a dictatorship really, I think, is clarifying in many ways.
Absolutely.
What is that noise doing? Well, what do dictators do? They control you. Mm-hmm. They are telling you what to think, what to do, how to feel. And you think about all the noise in your life, how much of it is, in fact, trying to get you to be a certain way, right? Or do a certain thing, from the music you listen to the commercials you watch, to the movies you watch, to the people you listen to on talk radio. Oh, just stick right here on this station, because this is not a dictatorship, right? But I love that. I mean, I think that really distills a whole lot into one sentence.
Well, and think about how often we're reaching for our phone, our fingers are itching to fill the silence, to fill that moment of pause when we're in the grocery store line and we have to wait those couple minutes. Or when we're in the car and we have to turn on the radio, or when we're reading, and I think this is an issue, one article after another after another. At the end of the day, do we really learn anything, or are we just filling the void, filling time? And, you know, it actually totally kind of different in a sense, Dawn, but I was flying recently, and I was on the bus going back to pick up my car when I was getting back into town in the parking lot at the airport. And there was this family, beautiful family, four sons, probably age range 17 to about 10-ish. And four sons, husband and wife, were sitting there. And I'm sitting here and noticing that everyone in the bus is enchanted by this family. They're kind of like eavesdropping on their conversations, glancing over, smiling. And I'm sitting here thinking, what's so unique about this family? Well, first I realized that it was just nice to see a husband and a wife and their family there with their children.
Yeah.
And then it was nice to see them talking. Well, you know what I realized? Not a single one of the family members had a phone out, nor were they looking at a phone and interacting. They were sitting in silence and then occasionally chit-chatting and making conversation. Basic, simple conversation that the silence and the conversation appealed to everyone on that bus for some reason.
It's like they dropped out of space. It's like they were aliens. Oh, what is that? A family that's not staring at their phones and visiting with each other. Huh? Interesting.
Yeah.
What a picture of our culture, for one thing. But yeah, isn't that beautiful?
It's a testament, I think, to this silence that can be on a social level understood, but can be taken even deeper. And I think that this is Cardinal Sarah's point, into silence through liturgy and prayer, that it's a moment to be liturgically active as an individual and uniting ourselves to God.
And uniting ourselves to each other as well.
Yes.
Right? I mean, as I'm picturing the family there, if you have been in a situation at a family gathering or whatever, where everyone is on their phones, you don't really get the personal interaction that maybe you did in the past, right? I've actually experienced this where you've had, like, hey, in the past, this would have been a lot more fun. Now you're all staring at your phones, right?
It can be very uncomfortable now.
It's very uncomfortable,
especially
right?
Especially if you're the one who doesn't have their phone out.
Yeah, exactly.
And you almost are tempted to take it out just to make things feel more comfortable or normal, like you're not the oddball sticking out.
Well, and you're not interacting with anyone. You do sort of stick out, but that interaction becomes impossible when we always have the noise or the distractions. It's dictating to us, not in a good way. I mean, I'm trying to think what classical music, yes, some liturgical chants, that might be, you know, good. That might help us. But most of the noise that we get in our culture today, You're right. You said it struck me. You said you at the end of the day you haven't learned anything, and you know, hopefully maybe you've learned a couple of not meaningless facts. I think most of the stuff we learn is, if we learn anything, is not useful. But maybe hopefully we have. But you know what we have? We have been influenced emotionally. I bet we've been made more angry at certain things.
Oh, absolutely.
During the day, right? Mm-hmm. Or we've been made more lustful by the music and the stuff that we've watched. We have been affected. by our media. And it has moved us in a particular way. And I think if we were honest, if we could be silent enough to be self-reflective enough for a moment, probably all the noise that has affected us this way has made us less virtuous in some way.
You know, I think you just made a very profound comment that while we may not have learned anything, we have felt and emotionally responded. And that, in a sense, creates a different type of education.
Oh,
and it moves us to behave in a different way. And that could be harmful. And not that we're saying, hey, just sit in utter silence all the time. Don't watch TV. Don't listen to radio. Please, please do those things. Be a part of the culture. But there's a balance that we have to have. And I think we're living in a time so unbalanced that the dictatorship of noise that is mentioned is a real issue.
And it is primarily emotional. I think that is something worth camping on. And to realize that almost all of the media we consume is not intended to educate. It's not intended to really teach you something. It's made to have you like something, not like something else. It is intended to produce an emotional response. So that's what good music does. That's what all music does. But I would say bad music, you know, makes you angry or agitated, right? Like, or something like non-melodic music, it actually does something to you. It's just not good, right? Whereas good music has an effect as well. Hopefully it turns your heart towards God because it's so beautiful, right? You listen to Beethoven or whatever. It's the effect that the music has on you. Mm-hmm. What is that doing? And so I haven't read this whole book yet, but I'm excited to. The idea that the noise around us is dictating to us our character formation, I think.
Absolutely.
And it's largely through emotions. And so let's be careful about that.
It's a couple tips maybe for finding silence. I know for me personally, I mentioned finding time in the car. Now, I'm driving a lot more than I used to. So you can't always have silent time. It makes you tired.
Right.
But intentionally taking that silent time in the car, taking that silent time for prayer, even if you're just taking maybe 5 to 15 minutes in the morning and in the evening before you go to bed and before you do anything, those are fundamental. If you're not making that happen, a lot of people talk about self-care anymore. I think that's just basic self-care.
Yeah, maybe even just look at it like that. Like,
yes.
For me, I need this me time, only it's for God, right? But totally. Yeah,
I think that's really important. I think I'd love to throw this quote in there that Cardinal Sarah says. He said, "Silence is itself very, very efficient. It gives you the opportunity to see yourself, to listen to yourself, and to listen to God."
That is very profound, isn't it? If you want a clearer picture of who you are and who God is, you need that silent space, right? You need that time to reflect on the world. So I often think of prayer as just gaining God's perspective on life, right? You need that silent time to sort of see through his eyes, even if it's just to see myself through his eyes. That's still effective. I think that's what he's getting at here. So yeah, get that time, maybe set a timer in the morning.
Yeah, that even works. If you struggle to stay there, sometimes you say, okay, I'm setting it and I'm staying, keeping my butt here, even if I zone out, like whatever it is, that's fine.
Right.
Just sit there.
Good tips, Timmarie. All right. Don't forget to check our websites, timmarie.com and donjohnsonministries.org, to see where Timmarie and I will be speaking next and all of the other projects we got going. Subscribe to the podcast and don't forget to leave a rating. We'll see you next time.
This has been Trending with Don and Timmarie on Immaculate Heart Radio.
Trending.
To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmarie Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit donjohnsonministries.org or timmarie.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.